Hi folks, hope you're well. This is Jim Carroll welcoming you to a special series of Banter podcasts recorded at the Web Summit in Lisbon earlier this month. It was a pleasure to say hello to Michael Schamberg, the producer of Django Unchained, Pulp Fiction, Aaron Brockovich, The Big Chill, Contagion, Gattaca, Get Shorty, Garden State and tons more, and currently advisor to BuzzFeed Motion Pictures, talk to us about the state of the movie business in 2016. Please excuse the background noise on this podcast. The Banter Stage and Web Summit was located in the main hall, and there was a lot of coming and going on.
Hi, folks. Welcome back to the Banter Stage here at Web Summit. My name is Jim Carroll, and we're having these long-form conversations here today. If you check out thisisbanter.com, you'll find out more about this series. Right now, it's a great pleasure to welcome... You're the first film producer we've ever interviewed at Banter. We've interviewed Michael, we've interviewed many directors before, like Lenny Abelson and people like that. We've never interviewed a producer, so welcome to Banter.
Oh, thank you so much.
Is this your first time in Lisbon?
No, I was here in college, but it's my first time that I remember...
Very good. So let's go back. I mean, the whole series of Banter is we tell stories and we like to kind of like get people's life story. And like, what were you doing before you started working with Time Life?
Well, I grew up, because I'm in my early 70s, so I grew up in Chicago. I'm part of the first television generation. And remember when I was a kid, there were three channels, NBC, ABC, and CBS in the United States. And if you lived in a big city, there was a fourth independent channel. But television was an explosion. My parents didn't grow up with television, and I grew up with it for as long as I can remember. So I was always used to having a really close relationship with the media. I went to college and majored in English because I didn't know what else I wanted to do. Now I find a lot of kids, because I just spoke at my college, are majoring in media studies, which is sort of partly the default major. But I think the larger point is I was part of the first generation that grew up with media as such an intimate part of their daily lives. And there was this pressure early to want to make your own. Now, I was fortunate in that when I went to work in New York, I worked first as a newspaper journalist, covering crime stories, which is great training because there are only two things that you had to do. One is you had to get the facts right. The other is you had to get the story. People didn't care if you didn't get the story. So I then met some people, and this is like over 40 years ago, before everybody here was born pretty much. I met people who had the very first portable video equipment from Sony in Japan. And of course, this is portable video equipment, but back then it was a half-inch reel-to-reel deck the size of a attaché case, black and white, and then it was a camera that was equally as big, but it was the first time anybody who'd grown up on television could make their own television. Now, and I had the idea to do documentaries about mainstream events like the political conventions in 1972, the Academy Awards, the Super Bowl, because with video you could shoot 100 to 1, meaning 100 hours for every 1 hour you use at no cost. So I was just sort of on the cusp of people who could, as everyone can now, make their own media outside of an institution. Big difference. And now everybody can do that, which is why it's a great time. That's kind of how I got started. And of course, back then, it was very hard to edit videotape. You literally had either splice the videotape, or you had to like do a pre-roll of 3 seconds and link stuff up and press a button. Then they got the editing technology, but the barrier was really distribution, and now everybody has distribution thanks to the web. So everybody is creating media now. It's an incredibly exciting, optimistic time for that. In about 1980, I have three children, 39, 37, and 20, and my older children were born. I was looking to make some more money, and I had just moved to Los Angeles to do documentaries, but I was driving through San Francisco and I had an idea to make a movie about the Beat Generation, Jack Kerouac on the road. I didn't know anybody or anybody in the film business, but I knew that if I owned a property, I might have a chance. So for $2,500 on a credit card, and at that point in time, I had 9 credit cards. I'd take one to pay off the other. I optioned a book called Heartbeat, which was about Jack Kerouac and the Beats. It was written by Neal Cassady's widow. For those of you who don't know Neal Cassady, he was a famous Beat figure, than a figure with Ken Kesey. And I optioned this book. I met somebody who had $40,000 from his family to get into the film business. We hired a screenwriter, director who was just okay, but he knew how to get a movie made. The movie was called Heartbeat. It was with Nick Nolte and Sissy Spacek. Nobody saw it, but all of a sudden I was in the movie business. And then the pivot points for me were the following. My oldest friend from college was a comedy genius named Harold Ramis, who wrote Groundhog Day, Animal House, all the Bill Murray movies. And through Harold, I knew the very first generation of American comedians, John Belushi, Bill Murray, etc. And because of the movie Animal House, it changed what the studios wanted to make as comedies. So I found myself with a deal at 20th Century Fox to develop comedies. And here's where I call my career good taste and good luck. Across the hall from me was a really great screenwriter named Lawrence Kasdan, who had written directed Body Heat. He'd written the Raiders of the Lost Ark, two of the Star Wars movies. And he asked me to produce The Big Chill. I don't know if that was a hit here, but it was the first hit I had. Because I produced The Big Chill, I knew Kevin Kline, who was in it, and more good taste and good luck. My ex-wife's sister, that is my ex-sister-in-law, was a roommate of a woman who was engaged to be married to John Cleese. So I met John, and he asked me to produce A Fish Called Wanda because I was an American and I knew Kevin Kline. That was my second hit. Then I partnered with Stacy Sher and Danny DeVito, and we had a company called Jersey Films. And our whole philosophy was to find the next generation of commercial films. We found Quentin Tarantino. My ex-partner Stacy came in at lunch one day and said, "You should read this script. It's great." It was the script for Reservoir Dogs. And I said to her, "Whatever this guy wants to do next, let's just do it." So because Danny had a lot of clout then, we made a deal with Quentin and his partner Lawrence Bender to do Pulp Fiction before he'd even directed Reservoir Dogs, much less Pulp Fiction. We did get Chori, we did Gattaca, we did a lot of movies that sort of pushed the marketplace forward. And just because you want to reinvigorate Hollywood with fresh faces and fresh ideas.
I want to go back to something. I mean, you brought things up in terms of your engagement with the Hollywood machine there. I want to go back to what you were talking about earlier on, though, Michael. You were talking about like that guerrilla TV time where you could make your own kind of, you could make your own things. And you said the problem then was distribution, you know, which kind of strikes me as something that you've managed to solve these days.
Well, I've solved it at the budget levels that it takes for Hollywood entertainment, but everybody can solve it now and make their own movies, make their own short-form videos. And the work I do at BuzzFeed, which is taking literally BuzzFeed stories or stories that could be part of BuzzFeed and turning them into films, it's because they make 70 videos a week at a cost of $1,000 each. And those are videos are like laboratories for, you know, what people might want to see. And the whole ethic of BuzzFeed is that Jonah Peretti, who founded BuzzFeed, and Zay Frank, who founded BuzzFeed Motion Pictures, you ought to realize that the story he tells, if I'm getting it right, is that Google changed its algorithm. And this is a while ago, and BuzzFeed wasn't getting as much traffic. It was actually a mistake that Google had made, but they came to realize that search engine optimization, meaning just the clicks, weren't as important as videos that people shared. And they figured out why people shared. They've shared because it was an emotional gift. They shared because they wanted to inform people. And they shared because it was identity. So when you dig down on that, why do people share? They share for feeling. If you dig down on all the entertainment we all create, we're selling feeling. It's the most ephemeral and yet the most visceral thing. So if BuzzFeed can do 70 videos a week at $1,000 a video, it becomes an engine for discovering ideas that you can then upstream into movies and TV. Okay. I'm not an employee of BuzzFeed, I'm a consultant.
You're a consultant, exactly. So, like, I mean, take those kind of, like, I mean, those 70 possible ideas. In many ways, they're kind of like 70 possible pictures or 70 possible scripts, right? So you look at it like that kind of way. What do you, like, I mean, aside from the feeling and the empathy, and, like, what else are you looking for? Are you looking for stars to be attached? I'm curious.
I'll give you two examples of projects we're doing. One is about 2 years ago, an employee of BuzzFeed lost his cell phone in New York. It turned out it was stolen. Somebody took it to Hong Kong and resold it. About a year later, he starts getting pictures of an orange man in front of, rather, of a Chinese man in front of an orange tree in China. Because whoever had his phone left photo sharing on. He became very mysterious. Who's this guy? He sees this guy with his children. He wrote about it on BuzzFeed. Somebody translated it into Mandarin. It went on Weibo, a huge site in China. 60 million people read it. And they found the Chinese guy. They brought the American guy over. They became an internet sensation in China. They became friends. So we're now developing for Warner Brothers a comedy based on this, and it's partly a cross-cultural friendship. It's also a friendship about, it's also a movie about how the internet brings people together. We're doing another idea. There's a tradition of romantic comedies in film, like, say, Valentine's Day or Love Actually. We just did a video called 13 Ways to Fall in Love. It's been used as a testing ground for a conventional, in the sense that there's a market for it, unconventional in the sense that there's a story for it, and take that to studios. So it becomes sort of like a, all the studios want some underlying intellectual property, Marvel Comics, DC Comics, books. This is another way of creating that.
I'm curious as well, though, like, I mean, Michael, given the fact that you have such an engagement with the old traditional industry, you know, when you kind of, like, meet your boys, meet your friends, wherever you're meeting, in whatever restaurant, wherever you're meeting for breakfast, and they kind of go, they look at you kind of go, okay, you're now the BuzzFeed guy, you know. Do they look upon you as kind of eating their lunch, or do they look upon you as kind of
no,
a collaborator?
You know, first of all, I got into it because I knew the business was changing. The big thing is this. You have to take the tech model and the legacy media model. In a tech model, people spend money to build audience, Amazon being the biggest case in point, Uber, which lost literally $1 billion last quarter, Netflix, even though they make money, they borrow $1 billion a year, and BuzzFeed, too, even though they're profitable, has equity financing. In the tech world, you make the product first, monetize later. In the media world, without a P&L, a profit and loss, nobody will make a movie unless they think they can sell it. So we're sort of in the middle of that, trying to use the tech financing model to create stories that we can bring into a more legacy studio model, which isn't going away.
Right. Okay. So, like, I mean, as you said there, like, I mean, there's a P&L kind of like attachment. So you're looking to make money. I'm curious about, like, you know, what's the kind of like the conversation then around talent, you know? Because, I mean, for years you as you were going through all the films you worked on, you highlighted the people, you highlighted directors like Quentin Tarantino, people like Danny DeVito from Jersey Films. What's the take now in terms of talent? When they hear you're now kind of consulting with BuzzFeed.
Well, talent just wants a good script. So whoever can get a good script, I can get talent now. When I started out in the movie business 30 years ago, the box office was 84% domestic American films, 16% world films. It's now 72% international films, 28% domestic. The type of movies that travel, it's Marvel films, fantasy characters, stuff blows up. The smaller films that Hollywood used to make are the more interesting films. You can still finance them, and they get released around Oscar time. A lot of that's matriculated to TV. TV's great. Netflix is great. Amazon is great. So there's more good storytelling now. So until I can demonstrate that you can make money from this model, you know, nobody's going to take it seriously, except that if I can come up with a great script, I can get people to do it. I have a saying, which is, if you give me two suitcases, one that has $500 million in film financing and the other has five good scripts, I take the five good scripts.
You mentioned there, Michael, about, like, you know, the fact that, like, TV is kind of where innovative stuff is right now. And it's interesting, like, I mean, I'm even looking at kind of like traditional TVs, like channels like Stars or whatever, and they've had a huge hit this year with Atlanta, which is a real...
Atlanta is on FX in this case.
Sorry, FX. Like, so they've had a punt on something very, very left field, you know? Do you think, you know, the successes like that and the success of kind of like various things like Transparent via Amazon, other Netflix hits, is going to make the people who, the gatekeepers, take more chances?
Well, the gatekeepers aren't really the gatekeepers anymore, and they know that, okay? So there are no gatekeepers because everybody wants you to watch their product on any platform, cell phones, laptops, iPhones, iPads. So they're not gatekeepers anymore. They just want to sell their stuff. And the more interesting idea is, what are their moves, which I consider defensive? For example, AT&T, which owns DirecTV, a big satellite provider, just bought Time Warner. If the sale goes through, I'm happy for my friends at Time Warner because their stock is worth more, but it doesn't mean anything. They can't. Time Warner has HBO, this, that. You're going to be able to get Time Warner movies and HBO TV, like Game of Thrones, anywhere you want. They can't afford to not sell it to you. So it's hard to know what the advantage is. And here's where the legacy media is slow to change. If Snapchat, which probably had a couple $1 billion in financing, is going to go public at even $40 or $45 billion, that's half of what Time Warner is being sold for. So So these legacy studios are acting defensively, and the creators are going to come from different places. They may sell out, but they are not the ones who are going to create the content. And the only viewing pattern they can control is they'll sell you what you want to see, wherever you want to see it. I'm on DirecTV, and if I want to watch on my we have a desktop in our kitchen, or if I want to watch on my phone, I just say I'm a DirecTV subscriber, and I can watch 300 channels. So nobody can control it anymore. Now, the economics are different. For example, if you look at a TV show, which is a big hit in the States, like Mad Men, they never got more than 2 or 3 million people. But it was a very prestige show that branded the network, so that if you had a TV show that got 2 or 3 million viewers on a broadcast network, they'd literally cancel it overnight. So broadcast isn't going away, or cable, because they have huge promotional platforms that can get people to watch, and everybody wants hits. Everybody is hit-driven. You know, House of Cards, as we said, branded Netflix. You've got Breaking Bad, The Walking Dead, Game of Thrones. Everybody wants those, and it's the system that creates that where people are going to win.
It's interesting what you say about something like Mad Men that never attracted that big audience, yet for the channel, it was something they wanted to have. You know, in many ways, it's almost like, you know, when people go on about, like, you know, creatives doing things for profile, you know, it comes down to that intangible value you apply to something like that.
Well, the tangible value is it creates a cultural conversation that people start talking about. And people in a certain demographic, 18 to 49, are talking about it. You know, BMW is all over here. BMW is, our Mercedes is a big sponsor of Mad Men because they know they're getting their target demographic. So this sort of targeting, these sort of targeted critical successes matter just as much as the big mass audience stuff.
You use a very interesting expression there. You talk about, like, I mean, the cultural conversation around things, you know. And, like, you know, from your position, obviously you're still involved in conventional films as well as working with kind of BuzzFeed. You know, how do you work things out in terms of deciding which goes where?
It's partly instinct. It's probably what I can get financing for. I mean, there are ideas that I find interesting, and they'd be very hard to get financing for. And so I'm looking for stuff I care about that I think I can get financing for. Remember, if you do a movie for $7 or $8 million, some studio has to spend $15 to $20 million to market it. So let's say that's $25 million, even for an independent film. $25 million is like an A round for a tech company, okay? So the cost structure is very weighty in terms of conventional film. Now, the advantage that Netflix has that the reason they can compete for stuff is they don't have those marketing costs, okay? They don't need to spend $25 million to market a movie. And also, they don't give you any profits. They give you 125% of the budget, so you're making an enhanced fee. But if it's a huge success that was on par with, say, a blockbuster film, you'll never see any more money.
Wow. I mean, I hadn't realized that was the way they operate. So, like, yeah. you're already kind of, it's in many ways, it's the way, like I said, the way the live music industry deals with heritage acts. If the promoter's doing it, they just get a fee for doing it.
Wait, say that again, because I have trouble hearing.
It's basically a bit like the way the music industry, the live music industry works with heritage acts. The promoters would just get paid a fee for doing it. They don't share in the uptake.
Well, the heritage acts are making their money less on album and music sales. They're making it on touring and merchandise. However, this year, for the first time, the music business is growing, interestingly, because I do think between the Spotify's and the Apple Music's, that people were always consuming music, they just weren't paying for it. There's a confluence of digital CDs, iTunes, kids in dorms with high-speed internet, so there's an explosion in free music sharing and piracy. Now, it's more convenient to pay for it, really. And that convenience factor means I just read that the music industry is growing like 2 to 3% a year, and vinyl is now a $500 million a year industry. They had to take a guy whose expertise was in making vinyl masters. He came out of retirement, and they found some old machines. Music is back. Music never left. Nobody stopped listening to music, but music is now back financially.
You mentioned there, like, you know, Michael, about the fact that things changed for the music industry because suddenly everyone's paying the Spotify thing. How do you think, kind of, like, I mean, do you think the whole issue of piracy when it comes to film, when it comes to, you know, TV is downplayed? Isn't as important as it was? Isn't as much of a problem as it was?
But say again and again, I'm having trouble hearing.
Oh, sorry, the noise around. Don't worry about that. Do you think, you know, you mentioned there about, like, the music industry. You mentioned about the fact that, do you take that? No.
my wife calling about the election, but I'll call her back.
Okay. You mentioned there about the music industry and how they solve things in terms of people now pay for the music. What about, like, I mean, the film industry, the TV industry, when it comes to piracy? Is piracy something that's still a kind of like a minus?
I mean, I hate piracy. It's like, you know, it's not helpful to me or anybody who creates it, but I just think, is piracy free or is it convenient? Remember, there was a convenience to piracy. You could get stuff you couldn't get on demand. It's still always going to be free, and it's still always going to be a problem, but, you know, people will pay for convenience. If it's $10 a month for Spotify or Apple Music, $120 a year to have 10 million songs and playlists at your fingertips, it's easier than trying to steal them.
I want to go back to like some of the films you mentioned there earlier on, some of the ones you didn't mention as well. You talked there about earlier on about like yourself and Jersey Films doing a deal with Quentin Tarantino and Lawrence Bender for Pulp Fiction before Reservoir Dogs was being released. Like, I'm curious. Like, I mean, we all know someone like Quentin Tarantino now because he's done the Django, he's done all those kind of films, Jackie Brown. Like, what got you at the very start? What was the X factor for you when you got that first script?
He was reading Reservoir Dogs, realizing this guy could write like nobody else. He's also a great guy, and he has an encyclopedic knowledge of film. He's just a film genius. He didn't finish high school. Steven Soderbergh didn't finish college. It's a combination of talent and personality, really.
Yeah. Say when you and Danny DeVito were kind of like working on when you were working on Jersey Films, you know, and like getting financing the old-fashioned way. What were you like as someone who was like going out there getting the money?
Danny was my producing partner along with Stacey Scher, and Danny had the same vision of let's find new talent, and he was really gifted at bringing in people and stuff like that. I only did produce one of the films he directed, Matilda, and produces other films. It was just we had this sort of shared, we all grew up loving movies, and we all wanted to take chances.
And, like, I suppose when people talk about film producers, I mean, you're the people who go out and rattle the can and bring in the money, you know? Would you consider yourself a good negotiator?
Consider
yourself a good negotiator.
I'm smart enough to know who the smarter people are, and I hire them. I mean, honestly, the key to success in anything is know who the smarter people are. If they're half your age, it doesn't matter. If they're older people, your contemporaries who just have experience. If you curate smart people, you don't have to be the smartest guy in the room.
Last couple of questions, Michael. Thank you very much for your time. I'm going to let you get back to discussing last night with your wife. What are you working on at the moment? I mean, you mentioned two pilots earlier on.
I have three movies in China. One's an action film with a big Chinese star. Another's a Chinese historical film. I'm developing a movie with Liam Neeson based on a Norwegian film that I bought the rights to. I'm working on a lot of TV development. Interestingly, the biggest event at the Winter Olympics is figure skating, and yet I venture nobody here figure skates, and very few people watch figure skating except once every 4 years. So with an American, a woman named Tara Lipinski, who won the gold medal when she was 15, we're developing a really cool series about figure skaters for Hulu. I have a series at AMC that's on the air called Into the Badlands. It's a martial arts series. I'm doing a series about an adventure series set in the contemporary Amazon. And I've got another one that's sort of imagining what the future will be like. Just I'm looking for stuff that represents where the culture is at.
Wow, okay. I mean, that's a fairly wide slate of projects to be working on, you know. Do you think all those will come to fruition?
Sure. I start everyone believing they will, and if I'm right 20% of the time, I'm happy, you know.
Listen, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks,
Michael.
Mike
Schamberger,
thank
everybody.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to Michael for joining us at Banter, and thanks too to Dara, Eleanor, Catherine, James, Kieran, Richard at Web Summit, and obrigado to our local crew, Josh, Caesar and Ricardo, for all their help with Banter in Lisbon. This podcast was produced by Banter series producer Tanya White. Be sure to check out the other podcasts from Banter at Web Summit, and see thisisbanter.com for news where we're up to. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll talk to you again real soon.